Welcome. Yeah, he's just arriving and the nose is tingling. And this session where we have a chance to both explore the intimacy of what we call death and dying, the mystery of death we can look at through the mystery of life, and to celebrate Abbot Catherine's life and teachings as well, the Sesshin. As we heard in another talk from Catherine the other day, death is the great teacher. And I feel like this way that we're able to sit with her, this Sesshin, and we'll continue today, this afternoon and evening, to sit very close to her down the road, that sitting is, we might feel like we're supporting her with our presence. I feel that very strongly, that she's alive and her non-ordinary consciousness that's operating now probably has some sense in some way that of our support sitting around her. And at the very same time, it feels like she is totally supporting us. This is like her great final teaching. Apparently Suzuki Roshi said near the end of his life, as he was dying, he said, things teach best when they're dying. So I don't know if we want to say better or worse, if this is the best Dharma talk that Catherine has ever given this week. But it's definitely a strong teaching. It's like her total authenticity, right? It's like it's not mediated by any words. To those who practice with her a long time and know her well, to watch her give this teaching is, it has so much to do with the relationships with her. And for those who hardly know her at all, it's kind of like, you know, still just as completely potent teaching. It could be anyone, right? Anybody going through this process now would be teaching us a lot. And the fact that it's Catherine, all the more so. Right? Reminding us of our own impermanence, which is so easy to forget. When I was young, I remember riding in the back of my parents' car through the, you know, driving past the local cemetery, several minutes of driving past, I guess, thousands of gravestones, and being at some age where I was starting to think about what that was. What does that mean? That these are markers of these living beings who are no longer living beings. That it encouraged me to think about that, and for me, it was a kind of feeling of joy driving by the cemetery because it's like, this is amazing. I'm alive. There's all these people who aren't alive and aren't experiencing this world right now. And the fact that they're like that reminds me that I'm like this and reminds me to appreciate the miracle of life. At Bukokuji, the temple I practiced in Japan, all Japanese temples have virtually all of them, I think, have a cemetery connected with them, just like churches often do here. And at the entrance, the kind of gate into the cemetery area of the temple, there was a giant stone carved calligraphy that would translate to something like, "We were once like you are now. You will one day be like us." A wonderful reminder of that intimacy of life and death. And been contemplating the practice of taking refuge in Buddha, as we just chanted, from this life on throughout countless lives, we vow to open to Buddha Dharma, to hear the true Dharma that's coming all the time. So, a little bit more from Robert Thurman in his introduction to this Tibetan Book of the Dead, as it once acquired such a title, I think long ago, in America. But it's like instructions for the in-between. That would maybe be a more literal title. It's instructions for people in between lives. Welcome, Robert. So yesterday I brought up Robert Thurman talking about Pascal's wager. He says, for even the most diehard materialist, Pascal's famous wager is still compelling. Pascal's wager is, if we become nothing after death, we will not be there to regret having prepared for something. In other words, we won't regret having wasted our time by preparing for that. But if we are something after death and we have not prepared at all or are badly prepared, then we will long feel bitter, painful regret. So we have everything to lose by not preparing and nothing to gain. We have everything to gain by preparing and nothing to lose. Should our preparation be for nothing, a little time spent on it in this life will not be regretted for eternity. Should our preparation be something before something, the time taken away from it for the sake of this life's business or pleasure will be deeply regretted for eternity as the waste of a vital resource. And Patrick mentioned that, what about this talking about preparation for some future thing? Isn't our practice just about right now? Yeah, and I think that's a good point. But the actual practices that are being recommended here as preparation are really just practices of now. just briefly, without going into them at this right at this time, he speaks of the art of dying beginning with preparations for death. And this particular tradition suggests that these five main types of preparation while still living: informational, which is just, you know, understanding what to expect. And you could say that maybe is kind of like a preparation. It's happening now, but it's about this future thing. Imaginational, and that's, in this case, being open to these descriptions in the sutras of pure lands in particular, and actually imagining wonderful realms where we would like to be born and live in order to practice the Buddha way. So we might see that as a preparation, but we might just see it as opening to the pure lands that are like imminently present right now, where the conditions are good for practice right now. Ethical, and that's of course just the practice of bodhisattva precepts, which will do us well at any time, not really a preparation, right? Meditational, we do right now. And intellectual, meaning he's speaking of understanding emptiness in particular, I think here. So the preparations for dying are informational, understanding that process and what might be helpful at such a time. Imaginational, ethical, meditational, and intellectual. So maybe we can come back to that some. But Robert Thurman says, so for those of us who have either the prudence or the adventuresomeness to deal with a life situation of total relativity or interdependence in space and time, can safely proceed to practice. There are no boundaries to our interconnectedness with limitless dimensions and universes, and there are no limits to our continuity of development, bad or good. A very powerful commitment to ameliorate the situations in which we find ourselves along with others arises from the understanding of the inevitability of being situated in infinite relativity and continuity. Which in his kind of wordy way, I think is saying, the more we understand impermanent or interconnectedness and the way we're all completely dependently arising together, the more we can work for the benefit of all beings and help. So we know this basic teaching. The abandonment of any reification of nothingness leaves us with an absolute preoccupation with the quality of relative or interdependent situations. This preoccupation demands that we use every means at our disposal to improve them. We try to be cautious about these words, like improve, in our tradition. And yet I think what he's saying is, yesterday he was talking about we often think that there's nothingness, a kind of materialistic view of death is that there's nothing after that, and that that kind of undermines this vast interconnected relativity throughout space and time. Given the boundless interconnectedness of living forms, beginningless and endless, and spread throughout an infinity of space, the materialist picture of evolution as natural selection operating purposelessly, yet efficiently developing life forms through random mutation from a definite beginning point within a finite theater of planetary environment needs some revision. This is the way he talks. Right, he's saying, just, you know, Darwinian evolution is pretty good. He's going to go on to say, pretty good story, but it needs a little revision. It's not really totally complete. First of all, postulated definite beginnings and finite settings are always suspect. Darwin would say, this particular time, particular cell first started life. The materialist account describes reasonably the material causal development process, but why should not mind as well as body develop and mutate? The Buddhist view of all this, the psychobiological evolutionary account known as the theory of karma. Did you know the theory of karma is the psychobiological evolutionary account of Buddhism? Psychobiological meaning, you know, body and mind, right? Theory of karma is very like the Darwinian idea of evolution. The karma theory describes a great chain of being, postulating a kinship between all observed species of beings and a pattern of development of one life form into another. Humans have been monkeys in the past, and all animals have been single-celled animals. The difference in the karma theory is that individuals mutate through different life forms from life to life, as opposed to just species evolving. It's more individual evolving. A subtle mental level of life carries patterns developed in one life into the succeeding ones. Species develop and mutate in relation to their environments, and individuals also develop and mutate from species to species. This karmic evolution can be random, and beings can evolve into lower forms as well as higher ones. Once beings become conscious of the process, however, they can purposively affect their evolution through choices of actions and thoughts. So, although the Darwinian evolution of species is purposeless, you know, from a larger perspective, and not within human or animal control, karmic evolution is purposeful and within our, you know, within the realm of our intentions. Although there are undeniable differences, the karma theory gives an evolutionary explanation of how beings are the way they are. So I translate karma as evolution or evolutionary action. Karma means action that causes development and change, and so is close to what we mean by evolution. It has nothing to do with fate. It is an impersonal, natural process of cause and effect. Our karma at a given moment of life or death or the in-between is the overall pattern of causal impulses resulting from former actions connected with our life continuum. The time of the between, Tibetan, the bardo, in Sanskrit, the antara bhava, means the between being. This is, by the way, not just a Tibetan teaching, this is the Buddha's teaching. There's a time in between, and this time of the between, the transition from a death to a new birth, is the best time to attempt consciously to affect the causal process of evolution for the better. Our evolutionary momentum is temporarily fluid during the between, so we can gain or lose a lot of ground during its crises. And of course the Tibetans are have this down to a science, an art of practicing in the between, learning to practice in this life. And in Zen we don't talk about it so much, but think most of you were here the other day when we heard Dogen Zenji saying in Shobo Genzo Doshin, when you leave this life and before you enter the next life, there is a place called the in-between. And you stay there for 7 days. And what's the practice? Here, instead of all the complexity of the of this particular Tibetan manual, Dogen's practice at such a time of the in-between is straightforward, just like in life. Just keep taking refuge in the three treasures without cease in the in-between. And as you approach your parents to be conceived, resolve to maintain authentic wisdom, keep, he actually says chanting refuge in the three treasures. Well, we could say chanting without a tongue, taking refuge deeply in Buddha. As you approach your parents, keep taking refuge in the three treasures in your mother's womb. Do not neglect chanting, taking refuge while you're given birth. Resolve deeply to dedicate yourself to take refuge in the three treasures as the six senses begin to manifest in a new life, and so on. So, our Venerable Sobun Catherine not only taught as directly as she is now, wordlessly and total sincerely and authentically demonstrating the mystery, but she also sometimes taught in words, as many of you know. And in January 1997, she taught, each moment arises as a world of echoes. That's a lot right there. Each moment arises as a world of echoes, echoes, echoes. You are sitting with your breath, listening to thoughts, following thoughts, forgetting thoughts. A world of echoes is arising through the 10,000 things. Buddhism reminds us that we're all puppets on a string, waving in the breeze. The strings are our causes and conditions. But who's pulling the strings? There's no puppeteer, just a confluence of causes and conditions arising and passing as each moment. Which is, of course, exactly what she's teaching us right now down the street. There's nobody pulling those strings. Causes and conditions. She's just according with causes and conditions. No more choice of whether to resist or surrender anymore. From the point of view of self, I have this history, these habits, these prejudices, these tendencies. From the viewpoint of liberation, these habits, prejudices, biases, etc., just arise. No one invites them. They arise according to causes and conditions. Because of their inherent dependence on causes and conditions, these energies are not self. Each moment thus arises simultaneously as not self, simultaneously as self. Not self, when we look deeper, we see just causes and conditions. Self, because they appear as like our unique personality, our unique tendencies. and habits and prejudices. Great Master Dogen tells us that reality is always going beyond. The condition of the universe is going beyond. Can you feel that on the threshold of your consciousness? Can Catherine feel that on the threshold of her consciousness? What would it be like to sit in Zazen and go beyond? Think non-thoughts? As soon as they arise, they dissolve, leave no trace. All these thoughts you have been having about your knees, or about Orioki, or your family, your job, worries about the future, regrets about the past, about Catherine. As soon as these thoughts come up, they pass. Nothing hooks them. Although that's actually what's happening, habits of mind reassemble certain thoughts pretty quickly. It's called reenactment. Thoughts repeat themselves again and again, unless there really is no hook in the mind. The thing about reality is that there's no later, there's no next moment when one's going to be enlightened, when one is going to understand non-being. Dogen is inviting us into a universe of now, where there's no outside, no second moment, only infinite first moments arising as now. If you recognize this as the way the universe is, everything coming and going, not belonging to anyone, that's the universe of not self. A sense of space. This is the secret to Buddhist practice. Svaha. Yes. What we're studying is the mind, not Catherine's mind. The mind arising as Catherine. And we've been studying for last year or so, mind only. And I don't know if Catherine ever, you know, brought out a lot of like Yogacara teachings, in particular, but here I think she's giving a really great mind only teaching. So what we're studying is the mind, not Catherine's mind, but the mind arising as Catherine. And when Catherine can hear and accept everything that's going on in her mind, she can hear and accept everything that's going on in anybody's mind. Nothing is outside her mind. As the Lankavatara Sutra says again and again and again, nothing is outside the mind. In that mind, there is no pressure to improve Catherine. It is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. She says, as the Dhammapada says, but I think that's actually from the Xin Xin Ning, the Song of the Trusting Mind, at the very end there. But if that's so, how perfect. But there's that little imperfection of where the line comes from, right? To be without anxiety about non-perfection. And since I'm not quite sure either, can we all be not anxious about where that quote is from? The Dhammapada or the Xin Xin Ning or Catherine Thanis? From that place, there's no anxiety about right or wrong, and yet there's complete understanding of causes and conditions. Mind, her life, and her transition into mystery. things teach best when they're dying. They slow us down, right? Everybody kind of like, but many people just kind of dropped what they were doing in their busy lives, which everybody has, to come and sit with Catherine. She kind of called us all to rearrange what we thought we would be doing this week. It calls us out of our usual busyness that has this underlying assumption that this will just go on forever. Yes.
Yes. You know, I'm a nurse and a hospice nurse, and so I'm with families, the patients when they're dying.
Mm-hmm.
And, Catherine is breathing nicely, and the face doesn't show pain, discomfort, but not so in a lot of other people who are dying. You know, there's always a rapid breathing, and often a rapid breathing, often facial stuff. So especially with the breathing and sometimes restlessness, they say, shouldn't we be giving them more medicine and stuff like that? And then morphine is kind of the drug of choice for respiratory distress. And sometimes you can give a lot of morphine and it's not going to change anything until the time is ready. So they ask me as a nurse, are they suffering? Can we give them more medicine? And my response, is not a, I don't mention Buddhism or anything like that, but I usually say they're not suffering like you and I think of suffering. In my own mind, I'm often thinking about pets that I've had who have died, and they just go off and just die. But I try to get close to that with people, and I usually just say, they're not suffering like you and I think of suffering. Like, yeah, I got a toothache. This is terrible. And sometimes, in the zazen experience, you are with the pain, and it's not so bad. So I don't know what, if you were in my position, what might you say?
I think that's a pretty good response, that it might be too much to say, like, oh no, there's no suffering at all there. They might be get suspicious. But to say that it's not like, especially, I think you're talking about on these kind of last stages when they're not conscious, and their eyes may be shut, and their consciousness is receding into a deeper kind of consciousness. I think that I would imagine, it's kind of our imagination, but that just like you say that, it's not the usual kind of suffering. It's like this, I almost think like it's this process that has to happen like that. It can't be like, they're just breathing along and then suddenly, boom. I mean, for a big, sudden accident, it might be like that. But I think when it's this dying process, that it's always the breath is this last kind of like struggle to that's like that's holding us on to connection with this body is the breath. So like it's struggling to stay connected and to let go at the same time, and like it's working itself out. So it looks like a struggle or a human struggle like we have seems to me to be something more like. Like as Catherine said, it's kind of impersonal. it's like this process is going on very naturally in order to like kind of shake free from the body. There has to be some shaky activity. So I think that's a quite wise and compassionate offering to the people, so that they and I think to it seems very beautiful when, you know, to not have to sedate the person so much that they might put their awareness, they might make their awareness more dull or something than it already is. I mean, that's a big question that's, you know, unique to each person of what to do at such a time. So it's really wonderful that Catherine's situation is such that she's, I think, she's not on any medication or anything, right?
A little bit.
Mm-hmm. So that she can naturally go through this process.
This is all going to last for a very long time. Not what I'm going to say, but my thinking about this for a long time. I have very many thoughts and emotions about this whole thing. Not all the other time.
Yesterday, various topics came up, or words came up. The idea of cultivating preparation is one coming in today. I think we cultivate, I think our practice cultivates, not cultivating. Yeah, I think our practice thinks, not thinking. And I think not preparing is preparing in our practice. I say that out of respect for Catherine, and of course she's written and read to us, and suggest that hearing Catherine's words and seeing Catherine, who is not dying, she's living as she's living at this moment. We are looking at her and saying she's on a trajectory of dying. Catherine is living as she is living at this moment, as we are. But that's all very comforting compared to the absolute craziness I was getting listening to her. That is nuts. I get much more creeped out about Bardo's and other lives and all those kind of things than I do about contemplating this moment, this moment, this moment, this moment, even if somebody calls it the last moment. That stuff creeps me out.
What do you mean, creeps you out?
I mean this whole idea that I don't want to be distracted. When I sit there with Catherine, which is intensely uncomfortable for me, but when I sit there with Catherine, I don't want to say she's going to a better place. I don't want to imagine better places. I don't want to do Pure Land and all that kind of stuff. It takes me away. I might as well read Danielle Steele. It's ridiculous for me. I want to be there fully. I want to hear every gurgle. I want to smell every smell. I want to be present, absolutely present. And that is living in this moment as this moment. It is not dying and going someplace else preparing for something else. I'm getting too puffed up right now. I can feel my passion rise. But I think an awful lot of our practice has to do with the ironies and the paradoxes that not preparing is our preparation.
I also feel this tension between what we might call surrendering to a process versus, at least conceptually, it seems that there seems to be this tension between surrendering to what is versus taking refuge in Buddha. And we might say that those are the same thing, actually. But, for example, just like say you're really angry or something, or there's some strong emotion happening. I mean, like surrendering to that, like I'm just gonna go with it, and just like this is my conditioning, or maybe like going with my conditioning and karmic tendencies. I'm an angry person. I'm just gonna like express it. Versus, and I know this sounds kind of black and white, and that's not, and that's why it's, the tension is occurring to me. But the other side of like, I'm gonna actually look, and maybe there's actually more to the story here. Maybe there's something deeper than my karmic tendency. Another reality. Another one. And we might, you might say at that time, that's ridiculous that we could say there's an other reality. All there is this karmic tendency. So this is maybe a kind of rough way of talking about, but this, I'm feeling in these discussions when I hear Robert Thurman and when I think about these things, or think about the terrifying visions of the bardo, if there are such a thing. You might say that, well, we don't know what's going to happen there, but maybe these terrifying visions will come. It's Pascal's wager, right? Maybe that will come. And at the time, I don't care, be prepared for them. I'm just going to be there with them when they come, which is a valid practice, maybe the best one. But this is my question personally is, these days, is like, is it just surrendering to horrific visions and basically being carried away by them? Or is it through preparation, maybe, or practice in this moment of opening to, like we could say, another reality, not separate really, but a deeper version of that these visions are nothing but mind, which is different than just being swept by paying attention to the visions and just being swept away by them. So I think that kind of dilemma is where these kind of teachings of the in-between come from. They're very emphasizing, don't be swept away by your karmic tendencies. Be with them, be totally present with them. Don't ignore them or think there's something, or try to get rid of them. But it might take great effort and diligence to actually see their nature when there's very powerful emotional stuff coming at us. And we don't know. I don't know. And Robert Thurman doesn't know either what's going to happen at that time. But if it's, you know, we don't need to imagine what those realms will be like if there are such things, but that I feel this tension between totally surrendering to chaotic madness that may be, like, I've experienced in this life some realms that I have a strong feeling may be very similar to this kind of bardo, like chaotic madness. And there's this tension there of, like, at that time, is the practice to just go with it and be swept by it, or like, use it, see this chaotic madness. Like, where is it coming from?
Man, before you go on, there's a comment. My root of this question, or comment, is this. And there's a path that I don't think you mentioned between these two.
Yeah.
In 2002, I meditated my heart to stop. With intention. Not to kill myself. It was the intention of total surrender. But it wasn't surrender to a fabricated idea. It wasn't a consideration of some alternative. My life indeed was chaotic at the time. And there was plenty of bardo stuff going on without a bardo, I tell you that. But I didn't challenge that. I didn't try to change that. I literally took a position at number 17, Blue Sky Lodge. I stopped my heart to see exactly what was there, to approach this thing without any construction, without any props. I had a near-death experience when I came back. But I find great similarity between that radical action of meditation and the simpler, more subtle things we do in 40 minutes here. And I find thinking about, well, not this, then maybe this, to be a total distraction. It may be some kind of practice, so is reading fiction. But I have found personally that approaching the moment absolutely without opinion and letting things just go and watching them just go is closer to what I understand by this practice. And that's not just running with the terror, and it's not having some intellectual understanding. It is an actual practice and experience that drew me to Zen.
And I don't think that that is so different from what's being described here. I mean, he hasn't gotten into it, and it might sound different because it's a different tradition, but I think the heart of the practice is very much like what you're saying, actually.
I'll approach it from that standpoint.
Yeah. Yes, Robert.
Yeah, I'm just thinking how, in the face of meeting death, our death, other people's death, we don't really know how we're going to respond. We don't really know the appropriate response. We just respond in terms of all of our conditioning and what we bring to the situation. And it's not as though there's a right way or a wrong way, because in terms of, you know, families and friends, they're sort of that's why there's a certain ceremonies that they're essentially allowed to express themselves any particular way and address it and meet it any particular way that they can or they will. I mean, I'm reminded of the story that Katagiri tells about the monks when there was an earthquake in the monastery, and the esteemed abbot and the ran out. They ran out of the room, and whereas one of the more lowly individuals had the mind to take things off the altar. So we don't quite know, the category goes on in some great detail to say that neither one of these is a particular bad response. It's just their response. It's just based upon their karma conditioning. So you know, I think in terms of when we're around death and dying, that there's not a particular way to address it. That we just address it how we address it.
Yeah, that's very true. We'll all need it in our own way. So I appreciate Johnny's, passionate vow to meet it in that way. And I think there's room to hear about other types of ways too. If nothing more, then maybe it's helping Johnny to clarify his vow when he hears Robert Thurman, right? I agree. There's no like right or wrong way. Even in our tradition, we should say, well, we should have the party line Soto Zen way to die. Even then, I don't think we can say such a thing. Yes. Yes.
And
we could say, from this point of view, that would be like, that's the preparation for death. But we don't need to think of it as, I'm doing it in order to prepare for that time.
No, in fact, we do it to live.
Yes, yeah, just for the moment.
Preparation to live.
Yeah, or just to be free in the moment, with no other future moment. But if you step back and look from the point of view of time and space, where we sometimes dwell, then one might say, oh, that practice you're doing in the moment, just for the moment, is actually a good preparation for facing anything, which whatever, we don't know what's going to happen at that moment of dying, but yeah. But yeah, it's our basic practice. Again, this tension between being swept away. Sometimes we talk about our practices, just go along with things, don't resist or try to change or improve anything, is very close to being swept away by karma, right? So that's why I think that's the tension that I'm trying to express, is we sometimes talk about practice as just go with the flow. But sometimes the flow, sometimes there might be room in our practice for, and maybe this is the controversial part, there might be room for actually not just going with the flow, but stopping and looking and saying, I'm not going to actually like just surrender to this particular karmic madness. I'm going to intentionally look beneath it with some effort, maybe some very strong effort. And some, this kind of thing starts to get controversial, I think, in our non-dual practice. Making great effort. Yes, yeah.
And so it seems that, when you go with it, you go really into a realm you can't
replicate. Yeah, and then you have to practice there with the result.
Yeah, and you have to patch up a lot.
Yeah.
So.
Which is, from a wider perspective, then that could be fine. Then yeah, you go with things, you get into some stuck result place, and where you have to do a lot of patching up, and then that's, you're just doing that.
And then the next time it comes around, you may not need to be swept away.
Mm-hmm. So with the basic practice of just being present with what's happening, we learn in these more conventional karmic kind of ways how things work. We can kind of watch karmic causality and without, almost without any effort, except just the effort to pay attention, we naturally evolve. Yes.
I love the way you use the word intimate with, Catherine Sherry's dying, because I really think that's true. I think that being with somebody with their dying is an incredible intimate, and, for me, I use the word spiritual experience. I was with both of my mother and father-in-law as they died, and my father-in-law was, as he was dying, it was very quick. That transition was very quick. But he was initially very afraid, and my husband sang and just kept singing, and he calmed down and passed in a, it was a really wonderful, wonderful way. My mother-in-law, on the other hand, my experience of her was that she lived in a lot of denial and just didn't like to name anything that was happening in her life, and that she was never going to die either. And her approach to death was that it was long and protracted. It felt like she was in a lot of suffering, is really a good word, because I don't think she was in pain, but she was clearly in suffering. She was very afraid. Her breath was protracted and difficult. And it was really hard to be with, and it was days that it was, and it was very difficult. And what it taught me was to make sure that I didn't live in denial. It was another way to teach, oh yes, this is why I don't want to live in denial, because it just brings suffering. It brings suffering now. It brought suffering for her. It was very difficult.
What was her denial, do you think?
She didn't want to die, and she pretended it was never going to happen. She just always put it off. She had a lot of fear about what was going to happen when she died, and she thought it was going to be really bad. And so she just put it off. She just never would talk about it. And so... but that was also her experience in how she approached life.
Mm-hmm. I think that's how it works.
Yeah. And so it just taught me that I didn't want to. I want to be like my father-in-law, or as I sit with Catherine, who I don't know. This is my real teaching from her.
Mm-hmm.
Is that that does not feel like suffering. It just feels like actually strength. I see the strength of that woman, but I do not see suffering, which teaches me that how she practiced was really authentic, because I don't think that happens without authentic practice.
Yeah, I think it would be unusual not to have any fear as we approach death. But our practice, just like you said, as we're facing fear in this life, is again this word preparation, not in order to prepare for, but it happens to be a preparation for the biggest challenge, because it's totally unknown. That's why it seems the fear of it. But the more we're open to all different aspects of mind in this life, the more the possibility seems that we could open to it as like the greatest adventure ever, because it's so unknown. But meeting it as the greatest adventure ever, not with some expectation like this is going to be great or bad or I don't know, but different than this, but just as one moment at a time, like let's meet it like this moment. So we can go practice with her a little more, and yeah, I don't know how long she can go on like this. Like you say, she's a very strong woman. Yeah. How wonderful that we have a chance during Sesshin to be like this. So if she transitions into this, like, I appreciate Johnny's point that, like, she's not dying, she's just alive. Because, yeah, there's just this moment, almost like you can't even say, and where is that transition even? But there might be a moment there might be a time we're with her, and she seems like, it's hard to call this life in the same way, even though we know we can't really define it. And then we can continue to sit with her Dharma. Dedicate any merit arising from this gathering to the peaceful transition of this moment to this moment to this moment of Sobhan Catherine Thanis Dyosho. May this moment include everything. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to rend them. Dharma gates are boundless, I surpassable.